postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town.
Two ex-federal narcotics officers wrote Rolling Stone wanting to talk for publication about the corruption in the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Before the story was completed, they were joined by a third ex-narc who had been instrumental in making the case against a recently busted Mexican heroin ring. All of them had worked out of the Los Angeles office of the BNDD. They tell a thriller-like story of illegal wiretapping, brutality, blackmail, a finely developed fringe benefit system of dope and money ripoffs, and a trip to the East Coast to debug Vesco's house and office. One of the ex-narcs, who had graduated at the top of his training class, has no doubts he was a good cop. The rub he figures was that he never had much company. Now, why did Jerry Lavoroni and Pat Saunders quit the Drug Enforcement Administration?
I think a lot of our changes in attitude came because of witnessing beatings to defendants, illegal searches, agents that were dealing drugs, favors to rich and influential individuals by administrators in the DEA, and the frequent perjury by agents in DEA in the drug cases.
Yes, illegal searches do happen. The legal seizure of narcotics does occur. Theft of money from criminal violators does happen, and it has happened numerous times in my career.
And in response to the question, isn't there an investigative committee within the DEA that looks into such charges?
It's called the Inspection Service of DEA, but this Inspection Service is such a political arm of the Bureau that they don't actually get to the corruption, and they're reluctant to look into beatings, to illegal searches, and to embarrass the Bureau in any way.
Their primary job is to maintain a strong Bureau image. If you uncovered corruption, wholesale corruption like we've experienced, then the image of the Bureau becomes tarnished. They contacted me 6 months after I left, and it was after I'd already talked to the United States Senate investigators, who requested I do not divulge my information to them, as they felt that they had their opportunity 6 months ago.
We've told these Senate investigators specific instances, dates, and times of some of these rip-offs and legal activities by agents. There possibly may be criminal cases and prosecutions in the future. We don't know. We've been told, or requested at least, by these investigators that we not name names at this time.
Jerry Lavoroni says he was a good cop. The rub he figures was that he didn't have much company in the Drug Enforcement Administration.
The agents that I work with, I considered a greater percentage of them incompetent as an agent, or I wouldn't even work with them in a black and white. Supposed to be big time. Big time cases, big time dopers. And if I had my others, I would have stayed in the black and white. Well, I was my own boss. When I was inside my black and white, I could call my own arrests, make an arrest if I saw it fit, or ignore it if I saw fit. I can only attest to the attitudes and philosophy of the Los Angeles office, which I must assume is the overall philosophies of Washington, D.C., and which is that the regional director that I experienced, Frank Pappas, was more administratively orientated, paperwork orientated, than he was enforcement orientated. You'd go out and make a case, and you'd never hear anything about it because you made a case. And like I said earlier, You had non-case producing agents. These guys made it in Los Angeles because they had no problems, because they had no cases. They just sat there on their ass and wrote reports of insignificant facts, and they went up in the Bureau. Now, the Bureau gets appropriated funds from Congress based on a need factor. That need factor is we expend X amount of dollars in a fiscal year. Now, the question is, how does Congress allocate X amount of dollars to the Bureau if our job was just sitting on our rear ends in the office? So towards the end of the fiscal year, they have a big push, everybody goes out and make a bunch of arrests. And then you get your physical appropriations because you got your numbers to show that this is what the taxpayers' money is going for. And everything we buy is taxpayers' money. All the money that we spend on the street belongs to Mr. Citizen. That's money out of his taxes that we buy narcotics with.
And did it have any effect on drug traffic?
Hell no. You're not going to stop heroin traffic by busting the hype. Yeah, hype's a guy that fixes. He's got a daily habit or every other day type habit. And it's just common practice. A hype has a record as long as your arm. You can arrest him and arrest him and arrest him. He's got a physiological habit. He's got to have heroin. By busting them, the philosophy was that the source wouldn't have anybody to sell his merchandise to. Well, that's a lot of crap. They'll always have a weak personality that's going to want to stick a spike in his arm. It just didn't work. The philosophy was ridiculous, and it came from the White House all the way down to us. I just agreed with him completely.
And nobody has to think too much about Desolation Row.
While Robert Vesco was under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission, Pat Saunders was flown to the East Coast to debug Vesco's house and offices. Now, what did that trip have to do with drug enforcement?
I was told by my superior that we were going on a job to the East Coast, nothing more. I wasn't told who it was. And in my opinion, at that time anyway, I was on official business as a federal narcotics agent. I've come to learn that possibly that was not the case, that it wasn't official business, or at least it wasn't narcotics business. I didn't know that at the time. And I didn't know who Robert Vesco was at that time. And
he was directed by the deputy regional director of the Los Angeles office to perform that duty, who was the head of enforcement. When he tells us what to do, by God, we better do it.
I think around July of 74, I was called to Washington, D.C. under subpoena to testify before Senator Jackson's subcommittee on investigations. At that time, I took the Fifth Amendment, although I did speak with the investigators, I explained all the details regarding the trip, and I went into extensive DEA corruption and mismanagement. I understand they're continuing their investigation, and myself and Mr. Lavaroni stand willing to help them in any way we can. Although we're both qualified in law enforcement and surveillance, they've made it impossible for us to get any kind of employment because of their bad recommendations. And they've ran our telephone tolls, they followed us.
An informant was hired by the Bureau to initiate a case against Pat Saunders and Jerry Lavaroni. The informant divulges information to us on his own volition, and our advice to him was, you know, whatever you're being paid to do, you know, go ahead and do it, because we don't have anything to hide. And he was told he would get $1,000 a month to get Lavaroni and Saunders at any cost, and that's a quote.
Not unless you mail them from Desolation Row.
In describing their work in narcotics, Lavaroni said,
I was an undercover agent. I obtained the services of paid informants, either working off a beef, which is an arrest for a lesser sentence, or an informant who wanted to merely do it for the monetary gain. This informant introduced me to major violators who I would negotiate with for major quantities of narcotics. Maintaining your disguise is basically something that is inherent in you. You've got to be able to convince the violator that you're one of his group, his type of individual. This is done by a personality structure that you develop, that you feel comfortable with. Mine always was that I was a mafioso, and I spoke with a New York accent, wore sunglasses, and dressed like these dopers think that a mafia hood would dress like. And it's there's no real disguise. I mean, you don't put on a wig, or you don't put on a mustache, or but it's the guy that looks hard and looks mean and that doesn't take any crap while he's negotiating that's usually the better undercover agent.
After I went to training school, I returned to Los Angeles and worked for several months in an undercover capacity in one of the enforcement groups. But primarily my work was done in electronics field, and I headed the investigation and was the case agent of all the wiretap investigation and all the conspiracy investigations that we had within Los Angeles. In my It's been my experience that the police work kind of hand in glove with the telephone company. And one case I'd have to cite to illustrate that is that we had a wiretap case in Los Angeles area one time where the suspect called the telephone company and requested that her telephones be checked out by the telephone company. Her being a customer of the telephone company, it was a reasonable request, I believe. Anyway, the security office of the telephone company called the command post where we were conducting this wiretap and told us that they were going to check the lines in about 5 minutes. We then got off the telephone lines. They checked the lines. They called us back, said they were finished. We got back on the telephone lines, and the telephone company called the suspect, the customer, and told them that they found no bugs on the telephone lines. Another instance I might bring up is that the telephone company gives police agencies and federal agencies telephone information, such as toll information. They say they have to be under subpoena, but not always is it under subpoena. Also, they listen on a customer's telephone under the auspices of checking the lines or making sure nobody's making illegal calls, when in fact they're listening to that person's telephone to find out if any maybe illegal activity or any kind of activity that they might want to report back to the police officers is taking place. And I consider this totally illegal. But it goes on every day, and I don't think the public are aware of that fact.
Justification for the listening is to substantiate a affidavit in support of a wiretap, which is called the Title III. They need probable cause to establish this affidavit. So before the fact, telephone conversations are intercepted to solidify the fact that illegal activity is occurring. Once they've solidified that fact, they get off the line and they go back and they write an affidavit in support of that wiretap.
That's KNAC Earth News. This is Blue.